This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests today are Brad Antel, who is the CEO of Salient Federal Solutions, and Bill Hoover, the president and CEO of American Systems. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Mark.
Been way too long since you guys have been here. So let's start this way. Bill, tell us a little bit about your background and where American Systems fits into the great scheme of things.
Okay. Well, I've been in the industry since 1980. After graduating from the Naval Academy in 1971, I served for 7 years. Got an opportunity to go work as an engineer at Ford Motor Company for 2 years, and then came down here in 1980 and have been in the industry ever since. I joined American Systems in 2005. My predecessor, Elliot Needleman, unfortunately passed away, and the board of directors indicated that they wanted to go outside for a CEO, and been there ever since. The company itself has been around since 1975. This year we'll do probably in the neighborhood of about $330 million in revenue, which is probably about a 10 to 12% growth over last year's revenue, which
Very
is
cool.
A combination of both acquired growth, the SAIC T&E business, as well as organic growth. We have a very focused strategy, and we are executing the strategy, and so far things are going pretty well.
What are your primary targets in the market?
Well, what we decided to do when we put the strategy together back in 2005 is we looked and we wanted to be involved with priorities, what we call priorities. And we said that probably the best way to do that is to go and look at the president's oath of office. And the president says that he swears to defend the nation and its citizens against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we said that, that is, when you stop and think about it, all enemies foreign is more of a DOD type mission. And but we said that, just supporting DOD is not good enough. And, the reality is you can support the commissaries and support DOD. And when I was on a ship in the Gulf of Tonkin back in the 1972, as much as I loved the commissaries, they weren't a damn bit of good for me at that particular point in time. So we believe that we have the best military in the world because we have the best young men and women that serve. We believe that we provide them the best real-time information on the battlefield. We call that C4ISR. We provide them the best equipment on the battlefield. We call that acquisition and logistics. And we provide them with the best training to use that information and that equipment to accomplish their mission. And we call that readiness. And those are three verticals at which we're focused. If you think borders in, pre-9/11, it was a criminal justice mission. Post-9/11, it's a criminal justice homeland security mission. We call that citizen safety. And that's a fourth vertical that at which we focus. And then finally, what we call national security, most other organizations call national intelligence, and that's the umbrella over top of that provides appropriate information to all the organizations.
Just a general IC community?
We are with a couple of the IC
I don't want names.
Organizations.
not. I don't want them privately or publicly. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Brad, tell us a little bit about you and Salient.
Well, like you, Mark, I started at University of Maryland. So
there you go. Go Terps.
Absolutely. And Bill and I share a common background that we were both in the Navy. I also spent 8 years on active duty and then spent another 22 in the reserves. And enjoyed my affiliation with the Navy, but really enjoyed doing systems engineering work, which I got exposed to while in the Navy on shore duty. And then started my career with General Electric, went through their leadership training program, great regime of training up at Crotonville. We got acquired by Martin Marietta, and then merged with Lockheed, and so I wound up spending 14 years growing with that part of the aerospace and defense industry, mostly doing satellite, you know, kinds of work. Then left Lockheed to join Ray Olson and a new company called SI International. He had a business plan to go acquire smaller companies, build them together, put them together, integrate them.
You guys were growing very nicely.
We were early mid 2000s. At the time, it was a relatively new concept to do that. There was a great arbitrage because you could buy companies for 3 to 4 times trailing EBITDA. We're almost getting back to that now. And the public markets were valued more highly. And frankly, there was a significant void in the mid-tier space. And Ray believed, as do I, that there's really a need for mid-tier companies to service this market. Small companies do a great job.
Small companies are having a hard time.
They do. They are having a hard time right now, especially now, given the challenges in the market with sequestration, the furloughs, the shutdown, and the like. I mean, small companies don't have a lot of capacity to handle that kind of turmoil. But they do fill a great niche. So for some customers, small companies really are very much necessary and fill a great need. And large companies are great because they have a huge capacity for those mega systems. But frankly, no customer in their right mind these days is interested in going down a mega path for a system. They're prone to you know, devastating problems, as we're seeing now with things like Obamacare. So mid-tiers really can fill that niche where they have a significant breadth of experience and depth, but aren't so bureaucratic and stodgy that they're really tied up. So that was kind of the niche that SI International was trying to fill. So over about 10 years, it took the company public in 2002. I wound up selling the company in 2008 to Serco North America. So it went from zero to $600 million in about 10 years. Obviously,
you're not doing bad with Salient that way either.
No. Obviously, I still believe very much in the need to fill that mid-tier space. And so I started Salient. We closed our first deal just over 3 years ago. And we're sitting here today north of $200 million, a business plan that takes us to $500 million by 2017. And again, focused largely on organic growth, trying to fill that mid-tier space. And we focus, you know, we're building a company today. So, you know, Bill's obviously got American Systems' long history, been in this market for a long time. Salient, a new company. So we're really trying to build a company for today's market. It's just significantly different today than it was 10 years ago even. So we're focused on technologies that we think are going to matter, that are important to the government customer, like agile development. So I mentioned big systems, not the way to go. Agile development is a way to allow customers to bite off small pieces of software to, particularly with all the systems in the federal government that need to be transformed. I mean, some of these systems are 40, 50 years old. They're still running on flat files.
Yeah, go out to Kansas City.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They're still running on flat files. And you wonder, they're still on tape. They still have tape backups. And you're going, wow. It's incredible the level of technology.
Wasn't that long ago when I would FOIA FPDS and get those great big reels in 9-track?
Well, you could still get them from a lot of agencies, so it's a bit.
Well, I just stopped FOIAing. Maybe if I did it again, I'd still get the
probably nine. Would. So we think there's a real need and transformation for more economic approaches to getting the government off incrementally using agile development. But we also focus on mobility and cyber. So those are our three technology areas that we're focused in today. Other hot areas that we're looking at expanding into are things like social media, because that's clearly going to be a big area. And data analytics is going to continue to be important for a number of customers. We're spread across DoD, Intel, and FedCiv, a little slice of commercial, because we find that the technologies of things like cyber and agile and mobility have a great play in the commercial market space as well. And it's an easy cross-sell into the commercial space.
Okay.
So that's kind of the company.
I'm glad you brought up the agile side, because one of the reasons that we have two mid-sized companies here today is that I think you're a lot more, and you implied this, I think you guys are more agile than the major primes, the 20 usual suspects, if you will. But why is that? I mean, because you're not small. but you're able to respond quicker to adapt to something like a social media thing coming down the pike.
Yeah, because I think, you know, our companies are in a position where we can make investments in capabilities. You know, small company, it's really challenging. They're fairly thin, so it's difficult to make much of an investment. But, you know, we trained 140 Scrum Masters for Agile development. So, I mean, we have a tremendous reach back capacity to bring those kinds of skills to bear. When we see as a mid-sized company, when we see a new capability or trend, it takes all of 5 minutes for the team to get together to make a decision to go in that direction, and off we go. Bureaucracies are in place to protect large companies from allowing any piece of the organization to do it any significant harm, but it also creates barriers to making quick moves in any particular direction. So we're much more responsive. I still make, you know, calls to all of our customers. As I know Bill does. So, you know, we're much more in tune with our customers, yet we have much more capacity to bring to them. So that's why I believe that the mid-tier is a real niche that I think is prime for growth going forward.
Yeah. And I would reiterate or repeat that as well. The fact of the matter is that we don't have a bureaucracy. As Brad alluded, I get around it to all of our office locations and customer sites twice a year and have an opportunity to talk to both our employees as well as to our customers. And so the distance between the people that, you know, that we serve, our customers, and, you know, the executive decision making is really like two or three levels, as opposed to, you know, a much larger bureaucracy where, you know, may never get back up to the, you know, C-level suites and that sort of thing. So, and I think that, you know, it's kind of interesting. I remember, you know, I've been in the industry for quite a while and, you know, I have a lot of friends around, many of them in larger companies, much larger companies. And I would say that one of our advantages was our size, because it's really, you know, it's the ability to be agile, to be responsive to the customer needs. And when I would say that, you know, I'll say 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I would kind of get a smirk from these folks because, you know, they didn't think that was the case. And now they're not smirking.
There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests today are Brad Antel, CEO of Salient, President and CEO?
President and CEO, sure.
You're President and CEO.
That's correct.
You're just CEO.
I'm both.
You can be both. You can be any darn thing you want. So there you go. Brad Antel of Salient, Bill Hoover of American Systems. So, Bill, you left off, you visit client sites at least twice a year, okay? So you have a regular cycle of doing this. So how many employees does American Systems have?
We have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,500 to 1,600 employees.
Okay. Brad?
About 1,000.
Okay. So not dissimilar. Do you know a lot of these people relatively well?
I certainly know them. You know, are we bosom buddies?
No,
no,
we're not bosom 1500, buddies. Yeah, 1,500 of my best friends. Yeah,
certainly. You know, when I see them twice a year, and what we do, or what I do, is I go around in that first quarter of the year and talk about what we did in the prior year, and then what we want to do in the new year, and then I go around again in roughly the third quarter of the year and talk about what the company has done the first half, what we want to do to close out the year. But more importantly, we're an ESOP. We're owned by the employees.
I didn't know that.
And so
I didn't remember that.
The important part of the third quarter is actually to talk to our employees about what's happening with the company as shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And so that also gives me an opportunity to go out and meet with our customers in a variety of locations. Just a humorous anecdote. Last year, when I first started doing this a couple of years ago, I don't think anybody really believed that I was going to do it. And finally, someone asked me to do it, and I did. And then I started getting asked questions, well, why didn't you come see me? And, you know, we kind of worked it out that they didn't want me there. They didn't ask me to come. Well, last year, now I get asked everywhere. And last year, I was asked by one of our employees if I'd go to Lebanon. And I looked at him and I said, you mean Lebanon, Pennsylvania? And he kind of smirked. I knew what he meant. It was at Beirut. Mm-hmm. And so last year, I spent a week over in Beirut with our security assistance team over in Beirut.
I certainly hope you had a security assistance team in Beirut.
Well, it was a very interesting location. I will tell you that, you know, it's amazing what the service that we provide to our, you know, allies and that sort of thing. It's also interesting to see firsthand what's going on the ground out there.
Yeah, but I don't see a lot of ESOPs in this community.
I think there are somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 or 4,000 ESOP corporations in the United States.
Right, total.
We are the 69th largest majority-owned ESOP in the country. There are a number of ESOPs that are, you know, do play. It's actually a very nice exit strategy for, you know, sole proprietors,
sure,
so to speak, or
sure,
sole owners, you know, because there are tax advantages to doing that. But what you find is that, you know, our employees, you know, when you're an employee, or what I try to explain to people is you have three constituencies that you worry about. You worry about your customer constituency, you worry about your shareholder constituency, and you worry about your employee constituency. And you make decisions oftentimes, you know, one or two of those constituencies get an advantage, and one kind of sits at the bottom, but, you know, three out of three, so to speak. And oftentimes that's the employee. Well, when that happens, what we can also show is that when we make that decision for the shareholder, we can explain to our employees why it's important for the shareholder, and they get it. And I think what we have is the workforce is really probably one of the most committed workforces I've ever been around.
Cool. I want to get back to the other question. Brad, how do you, you know, your company's 3.5 going on for 200 million, so the growth is certainly there. How do you get involved in the BD process? How do you get involved? How do you visit you guys have a lot of different contracts in different places. So where's your involvement?
We do, and we probably have a qualified pipeline, almost $5 billion worth. So we're chasing a lot of things and getting involved in some interesting areas, including foreign military sales, the FMS arena. So we have, you know, my business partner is Bill Parker. He's the mm-hmm. chief operating officer, and we sort of have a divide and conquer strategy. And although occasionally we'll do customer calls together, there's so many needs that we generally split up those responsibilities. So like next week, he's out on the West Coast with a Navy customer. I'm down in Tampa with a Special Operations Forces customer. So we just simply, you know, go where the need is. You know, I sort of have I try to get around and see employees as often as I can at our sites. But I try to make sure I'm not intrusive, so I don't generally make a customer call unless a customer wants to be called upon, because otherwise it just become a pain,
right.
And that's the last thing I want. But I do want to be sensitive to the customer's demands and needs, and we recognize in this particular environment, they have issues. I mean, our customers all have issues. They're facing sequestration cuts. They're challenged with budget requirements and still have mission priorities to satisfy. And so if there's a way that we can help them meet their mission priorities and more constrained budgets, give them more with less, we're out there trying to do that. And so my whole intent of trying to get with the customers is to understand what we can do to be more responsive, to be better at what we're doing, to make sure that we're filling the needs that are truly matter for them. And the only way you can do that is by talking to them one-on-one. So it isn't always out there trying to just sell something new or working a new proposal. I mean, there's plenty of that, don't get me wrong. And if I have an opportunity to meet a customer in advance of doing a proposal, that's always a high priority. But we want to make sure we're satisfying our current customers.
Right. But that brings up an interesting point. And I know that both of you have some extraordinarily talented BD people out there looking for those opportunities that are going to emerge soon. But when they need you, the difference between you and that top tier of contractor is that you have the ability to go and to help build that relationship.
Absolutely. In fact, I think customers value that. They, you know, it's not easy to get the, you know, you have to be a pretty big Cat A program to get the CEO of a tier one defense contractor to come see you, a right. Lockheed or Northrop. Or,
right.
Not so for us. I mean, in the mid-tier, every customer is critically important to us, and I make time to get to see the customers. So whether we have 10 people there or 50 or 100 people at that customer location, they get my attention. And I think that's important. It helps solidify the relationship and makes them the customer feel like we are important, that they are important to us as a company.
And okay. And I would agree with that. I am long past the time when they asked me to come in and help them with a solution.
Right.
What the value that I provide and that Brad provides and is really the to reaffirm the commitment of the organization to really make sure that the customer's needs are addressed. And I think that is really the value that we provide, because as Brad indicates, this isn't really done a whole lot, but certainly not by the larger companies. And quite honestly, I don't know that it's done a whole lot by other companies as well.
Well, a lot of the mid-tiers, you know, once you reach a certain level, I've no names mentioned, but I've run across people who really don't think they need customer involvement once their companies hit that 300, 250, 400 mark. And I, you know, first book said it, second book said it, third, you know, every time I talk, relationships are what drive this market.
Absolutely.
And because both of you have involvement in the IC community in general, if you don't have a relationship there, you don't do business.
And what I would say, you know, from that perspective is that, you know, when you really look at the role of the CEO's role is an external role. Okay, the beauty of being privately held, as Brad and I, Brad's company and my company are, is that we can be external with customers and partners. Publicly traded CEOs end up having to spend all their time with the investment community is the way I would probably describe it.
Well, yeah, not only that, but, you know, their boards may say, why are you out doing this when you should be doing that? So you got that overseer behind you. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests today are Bill Hoover of American Systems and Brad Antel of Salient Federal Solutions. What's your website?
It is www.salientfed.com.
www.americansystems.com.
There you go. So we've entered into a market condition that I've never seen before. I've only been doing this 32 years or so, but I've never seen the confluence of so many different things: LPTA, FSSI, the sequestration, the radically reduced travel budgets, radically reduced event budgets, and the inability of feds to attend events. LPTA, how are you dealing with all this stuff? And, you know, I'm particularly interested in your guys' answers, because both your companies are still growing.
Well, what I would say is that, you know, I might take a slightly different view of what you just said, Mark, from the perspective that, we go through cycles all the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember the cycle back in 1984 when we had the Competition Contracting Act, you know, as a result of the $3,000 toilet seat on the C-5A and all that sort of thing, and everything had to be competed. And no one had really done a lot of competitive procurement, either on the government side nor on the contractor services side. And so nobody knew exactly what to do. And that was when, if you'll recall, the $12 an hour aerospace engineer out of NAVAIR, Washington Post big banner headlines, PhD aerospace engineer, you know, cost $12 an hour, fully loaded, by the way. And, you know, and companies could get away with it back at that time because the contracts of choice back then were cost plus fixed fee. And so what happened is that you could propose a an aerospace engineer that, let's say, cost $100, you would still you could get recover the cost because it was cost recoverable, but since it was a fixed fee, what happened was your margin shrank, and that actually ultimately became why the banking industry or the Wall Street community didn't care for government contractors because margins were so low. Mm-hmm. If you fast forward to today, we're going through the same crisis of funding availability and all that sort of thing, but there is an important difference, and there the numbers of fixed price contracts that are out there, like we have probably about 55% of our work is fixed price. The fact of the matter is if you bid a $100 engineer at $12 an hour today in a fixed price environment, you're going to lose your shirt. And so there are some similarities and dissimilarities to what the market is. But what you have to do, and again, this is where our strategy, I believe, helps us. We're focused at priorities. The reality is that the government, I say this and I, somewhat in jest, in good times, priorities get a lot of money, and in bad times, priorities get money. And we're in a get money stage in our cycle at this particular point in time. And so what we need to do is be focused at that. We need to be conscious of what our costs are so that we can adapt and adjust to the marketplace, and you have to be a little bit innovative in how you respond. And then I would say the last thing that you need to do is you actually need to pay attention. This is where there was an article in Washington Technology not too long ago about the incumbency rates. The incumbent contractors are getting killed in this LPTA mm-hmm. market because they know what the customer wants, but that's not what the customer puts in the RFP and solicitation. And you have to respond to the solicitation and then have a workout plan.
So, Mark, I'd pick up on your comments by saying, LPTA is a little bit of contractors getting back somewhat what we're cultivated with the customer over time. There have been more and more protests. Now it seems you can just expect on every procurement for there to be a protest. And
can you expect to be appended to the contract if you do protest?
the whole, it used to be in my early days, if you protested, it was almost like a mortal sin.
Right.
That you would expect it to be ostracized from the customer, that slice of the customer community for some period of time to serve penance for doing the protest. Now there's no stigma associated with protesting. It's just seen as an ordinary course of business. And LPTA provides acquisition executives a way to get out of the protest option because technically acceptable is a relatively easy bar to get over, and then it's just low price. So what are the grounds for a protest? It really takes away most of the grounds that are protestable, the evaluation criteria. Best value opens up lots of avenues for potential protests. And even though that's the best way to go, the customer, I think more and more customers are recognizing that best value doesn't get them what they want. I'll give you a perfect example. We had a contract where we were an incumbent, and we lost the recompete to a Navy customer to an LPTA bidder. 1 month after the new company was performing, the customer put out a new solicitation for the same work over again. We won it 5 months later on a best value basis. So the customer recognized that although they got people that met the technical acceptable criteria, it wasn't acceptable to meet their mission parameters.
Right.
So they were quick, and it only took them 6 months to rectify that mistake.
That doesn't happen often.
It doesn't happen often, and sometimes customers just have to suffer through it. There's a real separation. It used to be your technical customer drove the acquisitions. These days, all too often, the acquisition executives drive the acquisition, not the
But how are they determining that TA factor?
That's the problem. Up till now, they've just been dusting off the last RFP that went out and resubmitting it for the next acquisition. The secret now, and it's not really a secret, if you talk to most of the senior acquisition core, they're recommending to contractors to make sure that your technical customer has real criteria for technically acceptance. that technically acceptable, the bar gets raised so that not just anybody can qualify, that they have to truly be technically acceptable when providing the appropriate price. You can't provide that $12 engineer who doesn't really have the experience to get the job done. You have to provide somebody with the right skills. So the challenge now is to make sure that before your mission customer submits the requirements to acquisition to be acquired, that the technical acceptance criteria are significantly stringent, that they get what they're paying for. Or you go best value. So, you know, folks like Ash Carter have been have said over and over, they don't think technically or LPTA is the right approach for a lot of acquisitions. But there's a little bit of a disconnect because acquisition folks down in the chain see it as a way to avoid the protest. So somehow that has to come together. And in the meantime, it's just going to have to be by stiffening the technically exceptions, the TA portion of that LPTA.
Right. And I hope it comes soon because, you know, this particular cycle has been here before in, I think, in the 90s with the desktop contracts. And we had technically unacceptable delivery because the cycle of computers that they were buying was so rapid that by the time the contract was awarded, it was already out of date.
Well, fortunately, there are enough bad stories surfacing that customers are becoming very sensitive. The mission-oriented customers are becoming very sensitive to that.
Okay. We'll pick it up after the break, but I want to continue this side, particularly to see how you guys fared during the shutdown. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guests today are Bill Hoover of American Systems and Brad Antel of Salient Federal. Gentlemen, we went through the shutdown, so ramifications for your companies were relatively minimal.
At American Systems, we had probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2% of our direct workforce was impacted in a negative way. So we were not terribly impacted either by the shutdown nor really by the sequestration that occurred in the May timeframe.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's really associated with the strategy that, you know, at which we're focused to execute, which is stay focused at priorities. You know, the mission critical people had to be in, you know, they exempted mission critical people and by and large we're in mission critical areas.
Brad?
We have our biggest impact was probably in the Intel space, which was a little surprising because, you know, there you think about mission criticality and the global war on terror and where we are. It's surprising that more of the Intel community wasn't considered mission essential. But, we had probably about 5% of our direct employees impacted by the government shutdown. So that obviously is disappointing, but shutdown in general is disappointing because I don't think it serves the nation well. But sequestration in general, it was a silly approach because it didn't really matter mission critical or not. It was a 5% kind of across the board cut, depending on where you were. So it didn't really apply much logic to the cuts, but we weren't really impacted by sequestration significantly either. I think the big impact from sequestration in the summer furloughs were the work slowdown. I mean, you basically had the government employees taking off either a Monday or a Friday, which gave you really kind of 3-day work week when the full core of the acquisition core or government workforce was in place. And so we saw a significant slowdown in acquisitions and award activity. So I don't think third quarter or our third quarter, the government's fourth quarter, was as big an award period as we'd ordinarily see for a number of reasons, because DOD was quick out of the box early in the year to get money allocated, but also just because of the fact that things slowed down. So, DOD right now hasn't made any structural changes. So if we go to BCA levels, which I think you and I both agree they're going to probably get stuck there down at that funding level, they still haven't made any changes. The Fed civil side, I see they've sort of, you know, took the sequestration, they made the changes they needed to make, and I think that they're going to go forward okay. They still suffer from a lack of transformation dollars. So most of their money is tied up in O&M, operations and maintenance. So they're going to muddle through for a while on the Fed civil side. But DOD, they still have structural changes that they need to make. They didn't get rid of anybody. They furloughed them. So if you have the same kind of pressure in 2014 on your budget, what else are you going to do but have to go through another furlough? So we've been there. It's going to be like Groundhog Day. I know exactly what to expect if we go through that again, and it's going to slow things down.
And I would heartily agree with the slowdown. We saw that with our, you know, decision-making in all aspects of the government with regard to getting RFPs out, as well as making decisions on proposals that had been submitted. We saw very slow activity. And also, you know, everything I've read says DOD hasn't really prepared for it as the civil side has, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. So your strategies seem to be focused on strongly supporting existing client base with migration, perhaps slowly in one side here, to some new areas. But what are those clients asking for? What new technologies are you going to be bringing to the table? I mean, are they interested more in that cloud environment? Obviously, security is huge. Mobility's there. what are they looking for?
Well, you know, from our standpoint, Agile is probably our quickest growing technical area in our company. We have probably 7 or 8 customers now that are making significant investments in deploying Agile because they see the advantage. It's a bit of a difficult scenario for the procurement arm to get their arms around because the nature of Agile isn't delivering a particular spec at a particular time. But the customers are seeing the real advantage, being able to get real usable capability out in the matter of weeks instead of years. Mm-hmm. And in this day, boy, I tell you, you know, you can't wait 3 or 4 years and find out whatever you're going to deliver doesn't work.
Right. They want to see that incremental move into the area and some relative immediate payoff.
Absolutely. And there's no reason not to get that with today's technology. The other area we've invested heavily in and we're getting some traction is the notion of mobility. We have a capability that insulates secure data environment. Most think of any government website or back end, their databases are secure data. And we have the ability to develop mobile applications where information is not stored on a mobile device. So it really keeps the information protected. And cyber, moving to
huge.
IPv6 is starting to pick up some steam, and it's an area that we've been focusing in for some time now. So those are three of the technologies that I think have long legs in the federal government and where we're starting to see some traction in terms of growth and sales.
And I would say that probably where we are involved at this point is really, you know, somewhat on the cloud migration for a number of customers. And what I would also say is one of the things that we are looking at is the old C4ISR is really merging into C5ISR with the fifth C being the cyber side of that. So we're seeing a lot of the cyber piece as well.
Okay. So are you doing more work on my side of the river?
An area that we are growing our business.
There you go. I like to hear that. Nobody knows where I live, so they don't know what I'm asking here. so give me some final thoughts here. Where do you see the big growth for mid-tier? How can small companies work with you guys?
You know, I would say the best advice I could provide to the smaller companies is that you really do have to have a strategy that you believe in, okay, which is really focusing, understanding what your capabilities are, what the requirements are in you know, the selected customer community that you want to go after, and then stay focused at delivering it. I think, you know, understandably so, when you're small, any contract is a good contract, so to speak. As you get larger, any contract is not necessarily a good contract.
Right.
And you have to be, you know, in the focused areas that are going to continue to get the funding and the support, you know, by your customer base. You know, if you take a look, I think that, you know, some of the issues that some of the larger services companies are, you know, dealing with right now is back in the day when their multiples were so high, it was so easy to buy anything because their multiples were so large. It was always, you know, accretive and all that sort of thing. But they bought not – they, in addition to buying what I would call strategic revenue, they also just bought revenue.
Yeah.
And I think that you're seeing a lot of that revenue being shed at this particular point in time because it's not in the priority areas where – you know, it's going to get continued funding going forward. And so I am a firm believer in focusing at priorities where your customers' priorities are and going after that in a very aggressive manner.
Okay. Brad, do you, you have a strategy for small contractors here?
Well, a couple of strategies. One, we always are out looking for small companies by the nature, since, you know, both Bill and I, we don't qualify for as a small company. So we have to have a small business plan on most of the acquisitions that we go after. And we always look for small companies who can help us build an advantage. So particularly ones who have been incumbents in the customer area, bring some relationships as well that are important. So we reach out to them. And generally, we're pretty open. So they come to us directly. We also have a number of vehicles that are attractive, and small companies come to us to sometimes get work on them. So we have Alliant, we have Encore 2, we've got CIOSP 3. So, you know, all the significant IDIQs. And as you know, Mark, these days, customers are trying to leverage the GWACs, the MAs that are out there to get work on because it's easier, right? They don't have to go through this long, drawn-out procurement. If it's under $10 million, it's not protestable. I mean, so all those things sort of play into the strategy of using a GWAC that's already, or a MAC that's already out there. So those are a couple of ways that we go after the small businesses. But my view is that, you know, we're focused in technologies that are really that are changing the way government does business. And that's what's important to a lot of smaller companies. A lot of them are fairly niche-y in terms of capabilities. You know, they're technology-oriented. And that's a great marriage with us because, you know, we are focused in real technologies that matter, you know, like new ways to deliver mobile applications, you know, aspects of cyber and this agile development. We have a scaled agile framework that is relatively new to the federal government. It's just being adopted more broadly commercially. But the federal government hasn't really started to adopt it on an enterprise basis. So we think we're relatively early to the game and starting to see some progress made there. So that attracts small businesses that are also niche-y. And let's face it, we're in Northern Virginia. This is a great place to incubate small businesses. There's a lot of technology being developed here. You've got CIT that has their cyber incubator to bring, you know, entrepreneurs with new thoughts on cyber here. So I think Northern Virginia is really starting to pick up some steam in terms of leveraging the technology.
Is that Nova Tech side of you?
That's my idea. Yeah, it is.
You know, I'm in the Howard Tech Council. I run the B2G group there, so we have a little bit of that over in Maryland.
And Governor O'Malley's a big fan of the cyber initiatives at the fort, but it isn't all there.
No. but the cool thing is, in the D.C. area, we have massive amounts of potential in that. And I think it really is beginning to dwarf what they're doing in Silicon Valley.
I think so, too. I think that's why the cyber accelerator sort of spun off of an idea that came out of Silicon Valley to try to apply some of the same capabilities in our region.
Right.
And you should join the Northern Virginia Technology Council.
I speak there a lot, but I don't live there. And
there's a river between us.
I understand. I greatly appreciate the invitations to return to speak, though. So, Bill Hoover, American Systems, Brad Antal, Salian Federal, thank you so much for joining me. This is not my day job. If your company needs to maximize the power of LinkedIn for sales, marketing, or business development, give me a shout. Call me or drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.